Welcome to Pharmacy Focus, Technician Edition with NHA, a podcast collaboration between Pharmacy Times and the National Health Career Association, a national provider of pharmacy technician training and certification. Pharmacy Focus, Technician Edition with NHA aims to provide industry news, trends, research, and stories focused on the pharmacy technician workforce. And now, here are your hosts from NHA, Jeremy Sasser and Jessica Langley-Lepp.
Welcome to our brand new Pharmacy Focus podcast at our new home, Pharmacy Times. I'm your host, Jeremy Sasser, pharmacy content strategist at the National Health Career Association, lovingly known as NHA. I've also been a certified pharmacy tech for a little over 20 years, working in multiple settings, as well as being a pharmacy technician educator for the past 15 years or so. Super excited to launch this podcast here at Pharmacy Times. Joined today by the formidable Jessica Langley-Lepp, my co-hostess with the mostest. She's the Executive Director of Education and Advocacy here at NHA. I did call you my podcast ride or die, not 5 minutes ago. And that is very true. Thank you, Jessica, for sticking around.
As always, Jeremy, I am happy to be here and happy to have a new home for our podcast with Pharmacy Times, who has been a really strong partner in both advocacy and thought leadership around pharmacy technicians, you know, education, training, industry trends. So it's been a great relationship and we're happy to see that grow and to see where we could take this podcast on their platform. So stay tuned.
Yeah, absolutely. And super excited today to be joined by two pharmacists. And I think they'll probably know what I'm talking about. I used to love getting the Pharmacy Times publication in the pharmacy every month. First thing I do, flip to the back to, can you read these prescriptions? Fan submitted favorites of the chicken scratch prescriptions that we've all come to know and receive at pharmacies everywhere. So that was the best part about cracking open the Pharmacy Times monthly publication. So our two guests, we're really excited today. We're going to be talking about pharmacy technician perceptions of patients who may have opioid use disorder. I'm joined today by Dr. James Wheeler. Dr. Wheeler is the Associate Professor of Clinical Pharmacy and Translation Science at the University of Tennessee College of Pharmacy. He's also the Director of Continuing Professional Development at the University of Tennessee College of Pharmacy and a member of the Substance Use Disorders and Therapeutics Research Theme Team, also at the University of Tennessee College of Pharmacy. Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you for having me.
And we're also fortunate to be joined by Dr. Mark Garofoli. He's the clinical pain addiction pharmacist at West Virginia University Medicine, clinical assistant professor at West Virginia University School of Pharmacy, faculty of the West Virginia University School of Medicine and Pain Fellowship Program, director of experiential learning at West Virginia University School of Pharmacy, and he's also been a TEDx speaker, and he is the host of the Pain Pod on the Pharmacy Podcast Network. Dr. Grofley, thank you so much for joining.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you very much, Jeremy, and the whole team as well.
Thank you. So I want to just dive right into this. Maybe if I can ask Dr. Grofley, can you maybe provide a high-level overview of the current state of opioid use? And I was listening to one of your podcasts, and you said something that hit me. We always hear about the opioid epidemic. You called it pandemic in one of your podcasts. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Good golly. Where does he get off using words like that? Pandemic, right? A lot going on in the world. But the overall idea there is that, you know, there's a lot going on in our world overall, but there's certainly a lot going on in pain management. In the opioid crisis, opioid epidemic, opioid pandemic, you know, whatever terminology we end up with, hopefully not stigmatic, of course. But the idea is that it's not just America, and it's certainly not just within healthcare as far as concerns go. But, you know, we're all clinicians, we're all scientists, you know, we appreciate numbers, but we got to respect numbers as well, too. Usually we look at population numbers, statistics, you know, per 100,000 population, whether it's our country, across the globe, or whatever. And that's one number, an extremely important one. But we also got to look at the raw numbers as well, too. Because obviously, when we're talking about the opioid crisis, we're talking about heartbeats lost. You know, typically, we're talking about Americans dying from a drug overdose. In our country, it happens every 6 minutes. I mean, think about that. Even our conversation here today, that means statistically speaking anyway, like 5 Americans. You know, conversely, babies born dependent on, not addicted to, but dependent to opioids every half hour, approximately. But across the world, there's other issues as well, too. It's just different sized populations as well. I'm from Wild and Wonderful West Virginia. I use the example. It's actually a tragic example, but certainly could have been worse, where a couple of years ago, I think it was like 5-6 years ago, a gentleman hopped on a bus. He happened to be a drug dealer. He left Ohio and he came to West Virginia, and he sold heroin that was eventually found to be laced with fentanyl and its analogs. There was about 24 overdoses within, say, 4 hours in one evening, and folks were flocking to that product. For the desire or perception that there may be a chance for euphoria, with accounting for tolerance as well. Now, to our knowledge, no one died. There was no deadly overdoses. But the point being, you know, he got off the bus in West Virginia. Our population is relatively small. What if the bus trip ended in Ohio? The numbers would be drastically different because it's per population. Yet we're talking about legal and illegal substances in this overall opioid crisis. So there's a lot that goes into it, and it is certainly across the whole globe, not just here in America.
Wow, so certainly staggering statistics when you break it down in terms of, you know, possible overdose deaths in any given frame of time. How does that affect overall, not just pharmacy, but our healthcare system as a whole here in the U.S.?
Well, you can't say healthcare without care. So first and foremost, you know, and us clinicians, we're out there to provide patient care. We're there to care. You know, no one really cares what you know until they know how much you care. That's incredibly important. You know, flip side of the coin, if I'm ever diagnosed with a late stage cancer, I might want the therapeutics a little bit more than hugs at a particular point, too. So two sides to every coin, but we're there to provide care in healthcare. And this overall, all of the sensationalization of real facts, real situations, people's stories, there's real stories out there affecting people's lives. And yes, there's sensationalization thereof, of course, but we've got to navigate that in healthcare, and it gets tricky because we take a lot of kidney punches, and I don't say that lightly, because at the beginning of COVID, I had a kidney stone, and that was a journey and a half right there. But talk about pain management and navigating it as a patient or within our healthcare system. But we, you know, a day doesn't go by where there's not a pain management guideline being developed or updated for that matter. You know, CDC is working on their update. The final stage is there as well for the chronic pain or generalized pain as well, too. Opioid guideline update. But we have a lot of noise out there within the world and within healthcare. It's always, I usually say it takes all of us to keep the boat afloat. But some people might perceive that as, well, who's to blame? You know, the finger pointing and trying to put a percentage on how much someone's, or even a dollar sign on how much someone is accountable, or an organization or an entity or whatever. And in the end, it's all about those one-on-one situations, maybe two or three on one, where we provide care and we show that we care. So it's incredibly tough, you know, for all healthcare professionals. You need the entire team on board, pharmacists, pharmacy technicians. You need every hand on deck. So
a question I've always had is, and maybe this is one of the things that's forever changing as well, but on the spectrum of a patient using opiates from the time when, you know, their first time, maybe they're admitted to the hospital for something, through treatment, whatever they need for pain management, how do we determine when a patient may have opioid use disorder?
So I'm going to jump back one step there. So first and foremost, there's a lot of opioid risk screenings that are out there, or at least multiple. I mean, maybe not a lot, but you know, we're talking nearing double digits. And those typically, you know, there's different examples, and how I usually go about it in talking with and educating all healthcare professionals is thinking, you know, two main questions. Are you going to be administering the conversation? Or will the patient be filling out a form? And then is the patient opioid naive, or have they, experienced the utilization of opioids in the past, especially recent past? Answering those two questions will narrow it down as far as what opioid risk screenings to utilize. But really, in the big picture, it's all about just screening for that risk. And it doesn't mean that if somebody screens in a higher risk situation that, oh, that's a stoplight or anything like that. It just means further conversation and decisions, hopefully, as a team. Then when you go, you know, later in the overall timeline, I guess we'll say, as far as substance use disorder, addiction diagnosis, we have DSM-5, that's the most updated. And there's a pretty long list of things. I believe it's like 11 or 12 items that start, adding up the check boxes per se, as far as what would qualify for substance use disorder. Interestingly enough, two of the things on there are actually tolerance and then withdrawal as well, which generally speaking, we don't really recognize as a absolute needed component of addiction because, somebody could still have addiction and have lost the tolerance because it's been a little while. Think about folks going into a jail system. If you leave a month or a year later and not being exposed to a substance, you're not going to have tolerance anymore. But the substance use disorder is still going to be lingering in the background. So it's really looking at the, initially at opioid risk screenings, which can be actually pretty quick conversations, but every setting is different, of course. And then the overall diagnosis of what we have tried and true for what we utilize as far as references for all diagnoses, of course.
There's a lot of gray area there, and it sounds like it kind of depends on what measurement you're using, or, I don't know if it's by facility or by, state or what have you, but there can be some gray area there. So there's would you say there's a bit of a subjective component depending upon the healthcare provider who may be treating a patient who is on opiates or needs to start on opiates at any given time?
The door is certainly open for subjectivity. Universally, you think about even controlled substance laws. When any of us present, self included, when we hear law, we think, bare minimum objective, right? Time out. Alcohol, ethanol. It was legal. It was illegal. Back to legal. Chemical never changed. Doesn't protrude itself as objective along the way. Now there's learning. Don't get me wrong. There's learning along the way too. In this case, for an entire country. But there's subjectivity abound in a lot of areas, and that's the. That's the beauty of the practice of medicine, the practice of pharmacy, the practice of nursing, healthcare overall is it's the practice of it. We're all continuing learning and hopefully providing better and better patient care all the time. And it takes that whole team along the way as well, too. Now, the whole team's got to be educated and trained on all issues, really, to provide that best care overall.
Well, I think that is a great segue into talking with Dr. Wheeler and having him discuss his body of work. Dr. Wheeler is on the show today. He was a co-author of a research paper titled Pharmacy Technicians, Stigma and Compassion Fatigue, Frontline Perspectives of Pharmacy and the U.S. Opioid Epidemic. Dr. Wheeler, can you maybe give a high-level overview of what this research was and really what was the catalyst for wanting to conduct this research? And I should state also for full disclosure, this research was funded at least in part by National Health Career Association. Dr. Wheeler.
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, Jeremy. And I agree with many of Mark's comments, particularly about, the United States has a substance use disorder problem. And one of the things that is a mindset and shift in the way we now train our students, train practitioners, is how to manage substance use disorders, including things like opioid use disorders. So it's not a criminal activity. It's a disease, ultimately. It's a chronic disease the same way that we would treat other chronic diseases like hypertension or diabetes, for example. Part of the reason I got interested in this line of research was we were getting comments both from our colleagues in practice and also from our state government that they were getting reports of people, individuals who were on treatment for opioid use disorder through products like buprenorphine, for example, were feeling stigmatized at pharmacies. And so if you look at the literature to see what's out there, first of all, there's not a lot. But we do know that many patients feel stigmatized or even discriminated sometimes when being on these therapies. And so we wanted to ask the question, why is that, first of all? And we wanted to know, is it life experiences that's impacting that in terms of clinicians? Is this unique to just pharmacy, or is this out there for all healthcare professionals? And further, we wanted to know, what is happening when patients are experiencing, you know, these negative attitudes or stigmas at pharmacies? Is it universal? Are these isolated incidents? Those kind of questions. So we assembled a research team to basically ask those questions. And we wanted to look specifically at pharmacy technicians for a couple reasons. One, if you think about where patients first interact with the pharmacy team, many times it's the pharmacy technician you'll interact with first. So if you have a prescription, you know, for any prescription, but particularly if you're, you know, if we're talking about prescriptions that are controlled substances, opioid medications, or medications that are used to treat opioid use disorder, you may interact first with a pharmacy technician. And so it's likely that first impressions, like any business, are made at the front. So if we think about a restaurant, your first impression is normally the host or the hostess. Many times your first impression can be made at the pharmacy with a pharmacy technician. We also felt like pharmacy technicians are in a unique spot because they interact with the public so much, and that likely that because their training is different from pharmacists, that maybe pharmacists are passing along sometimes these biases or judgments, or that life experiences from pharmacy technicians, from friends or family, are impacting their attitudes or responses. So this was a multi-pronged approach study that basically took two avenues. One is that we set up focus groups with pharmacy technicians. So we sent a call to our listserv out asking anybody willing who's practicing in the community setting to sit down and talk to us for a few minutes about their experiences. So I believe we convened five focus groups over the course of a summer and asked them all sorts of questions. How did you get in this profession? How many years have you been working in pharmacy? What areas of practice have you been in? And ask them a lot of questions regarding their backgrounds, their upbringings, their viewpoints, and how many, what practice models they're in, and how many prescriptions do they receive for these annually? And then we asked some more pointed questions about specifically what their viewpoints were in relation to treatment of addiction, for example. And not to give too much away for the study, but we came up with a couple of key themes. One is that life experiences played heavily on the way technicians viewed treatment of opioid use disorder. And so many technicians have a background with a friend or family member who have been through treatment or multiple treatments for addiction. And so that weighed heavily on pharmacy technicians. In addition, individual experiences can sometimes form an attitude that carries forward. So if pharmacy technicians had a negative interaction with a patient, sometimes that attitude could be carried forward. And so we saw that play into role in certain technician experiences. And then finally, we saw how basically pharmacist behaviors or attitudes can be filtered down to the technician attitudes as well. And so probably not surprising that you're working in a close work environment. Attitudes can change over time when pharmacists share their attitudes. So moving forward, we had a couple of different recommendations. One was clearly on training, that there's not a lot of formalized requirements for things related to controlled substance pain management or substance use disorder. And so likely there's a great opportunity for education as we work to better the care for specifically this patient population. And moving forward, that's something that myself and other researchers like Mark as well, I know are interested in helping this patient population.
Well, I think this is such a great topic, and I love the fact that you that your research focused on pharmacy technicians. You know, I spent many years behind the counter myself, and all of those situations I've seen, you know, firsthand. And even myself, it is hard after, you know, having one negative interaction with one patient, how that can, you know, change how you view, you know, the next 10 patients, because it evokes such a strong reaction, you know. And I think maybe this isn't the right term, but I think that sometimes technicians and even other, you know, healthcare workers, they almost develop like this hypervigilance against looking out for any misuse when it comes to controlled substances, to the point where it clouds their judgment and how they take care of that patient. I mean, personally, you know, my wife was in the hospital having our first child, our son. She went through 12 hours of labor being induced and never took an epidural or pain medications. But while staying in the hospital, you know, she was like, I'm having a lot of pain. There's something not quite right, you know, and she actually had one of her nurses recuse themselves of her care under the premise that she was seeking drugs. You know, and of course, it turned out they discharged her with a fourth degree tear that she then had to go back 3 days later to have emergency surgery to fix anyways. So, you know, here you have somebody who didn't even take an epidural now being accused just on because they're saying, you know, I'm in a lot of pain. Something doesn't quite feel right, that one healthcare worker take it upon themselves to almost diagnose her as somebody who has an addiction to pain medication. You know, and I'm sure that's not a unique case. I'm sure something similar happens all the time. So beyond, I mean, and it sounds like just beyond technicians, like what kind of training should we be focusing on for treating these, for learning how best to treat these patients? Because it really impacts the overall level of care that they receive.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think, Jeremy, one of the key themes takeaway here is that, you know, our corresponding responsibility to DEA regulations and, you know, providing compassionate care are not mutually exclusive. So you can uphold the law and all of the responsibilities of upholding controlled substance laws, but at the same time be compassionately providing care. And so that's the type of training that we need to do. And honestly, Mark and I are both faculty members. We need to improve the way we teach pain management likely. And so we have seen some reforms in that. Medical schools have probably a greater focus on that, and pharmacy schools too, perhaps than they have in the past. But we know that the number one reason patients usually seek care is pain. And so we need to do a better job, you know, teaching both acute and chronic pain management, as well as, you know, the compassion and the humanistic side of treating pain as well.
Yeah, and I wonder how that training too, maybe you guys, both of you can shed some light, how does that affect interdisciplinary relationships between, you know, say like pharmacists and physicians? Because again, from my experience, some of the more heated discussions I've ever heard my pharmacist have over the phone was with a doctor who was a pain specialist. And, you know, we were not comfortable filling 750 tablets of, 10 milligram methadone for one of his patients. And he was just so taken aback. You know, I'm the physician. Who are you to question my judgment? All this kind of stuff. How has that evolved, or how is training? Is there more cooperation, I guess, maybe between the two disciplines? Can you shed any light there?
I think there's definitely been a pretty good evolution, but it's not universal. And I don't believe, you know, typically when I have a mic, I don't give opinions, but there's a difference with a podcast as well. I don't think it would be a smart goal to have a universal goal of saying, okay, everybody's going to drop the stigma and the judgments and the personal facts. That means an opinion. Learned that from my sister-in-law. Personal facts at the door. It's, you know, Dr. Wheeler's study and all of our experiences together, one of the big protruding things is that, you know, we do need in healthcare, pharmacy, MDs, DOs, nursing, NPs, the whole gamut, everybody. We do need the education, you know, whether it's the pharmacology, the anatomy, phys, we need all that to enable the conversations that really should be involved in these various CEs. I can speak for myself. I develop and present a plethora of different drug diversion, SUD addiction, the whole game, pain management, all that. But the ones that really get tangible are when there's an open conversation. You know, it's the, you know, like drug diversion talks. Okay, what about when something is confirmed and now, you know, the dog's got the card, now what? How to go about those situations. You know, like the assessment, Jeremy, you asked earlier, we were talking briefly about opioid risk tools, and it's like, okay, somebody walks into an ER. I mean, are they walking in because they wanted the equivalent of a Flintstone vitamin for their pain? I mean, let's be real. Obviously, everyone is in some way, shape, form, or fashion, technically treatment seeking. That's why you enter the healthcare system. But having conversations in that regard of the, like, not labeling people, not, you know, like when I had my kidney stone, I went to the ER. Wait, what do you think I was? Oh, if you could just cut an ibuprofen in half, you know, we'll call it a night here. Obviously, there was seeking in one way or another for further treatment, diagnosis as well at the time. But it's just going beyond that and talking to folks about how, look, you're personal or professional opinion may never change in many accords, well beyond substance use disorder. You know, we could be talking about needles over the counter, plan B, even certain thyroid medications, depending on, you know, the source for religious beliefs. There's so many of these things, but it's the, okay, now that we've covered the facts, let's talk about how we handle them so that we don't get a labeling like, oh my gosh, what your wife went through. And sadly, to answer your question, yes, that happens every day, everywhere. Thankfully, not every single situation. But it's just, you know, remembering that we're there to provide the care. We're not there for our personal opinions, regardless of our title, whether it is MD, DO, PharmD, and it doesn't matter. It's we're there to provide that care.
I agree with Mark, and I'll just say, you know, if we look at advancements that have been made, data sharing is huge. So, you know, most every state has a PDMP that shares, you know, information and resources. I think that's been particularly helpful. But identifying patients who need help is probably an avenue that we're not as advanced in. So we're pretty good at identifying diversion as a profession, where we have tools in place. You know, the next step, the humanistic piece, is finding folks who need help. Really. And so that's a much harder thing to achieve. It does. It requires open lines of communication. It requires good relationships with everyone on the medical team. And that's not just pharmacists and physicians. It's also support staff. So, I mean, having trained technicians in the pharmacy is huge. Having them being able to communicate with, you know, medical staff, who play a support role in the physician office is huge. And so really everybody working together in patient-centered care really can be a benefit. And so we've made strides, and I think we've got a long way to go. The good news is that the number of opioid prescriptions are declining for chronic pain, and so that's likely a good thing. The work we have cut out for us, though, is finding good pain management solutions and regimens for patients with chronic pain. So if opioids are not always the answer in chronic pain, which our guidelines clearly support, how can we work to make sure we provide compassionate care for patients and help them get relief? And so that's a much tougher question that we've just not fully yet solved, I don't think.
And so I guess this brings me to my next question. I wonder then, in patients who for lack of a better term, are confirmed to have some kind of substance use disorder. So now they are possibly receiving treatment for that while also maintaining something that started off as pain management but has evolved into something else. What needs to happen with the way that we deliver healthcare to those patients, provide them a high level of patient care, and make sure that we're providing them not only the treatment that they need, but the support that they need along the way if their end goal is to eventually, you know, get off of that treatment?
So I can speak a little to that. I think the first thing we need to do is follow our evidence-based practice. And so there are guidelines out there specifically for, in the case of the medication buprenorphine, the state of Tennessee has developed practice guidelines. It is likely that many of the pain management societies also have practice guidelines nationally, if your local state doesn't have one. I think keeping open lines of communication with patients about how they're doing, which means you have to get to know them. How are they feeling? How is their family doing? Those kind of things. You know, it was at one point, and maybe even some insurance companies put stop limits on buprenorphine prescriptions. But the evidence is showing that longer durations tend to be better for patients. And so it is not a treatment algorithm as simple as, you know, we're going to treat with antibiotics for 7 days, then stop. There is no ideal stop date for some of the medications for opioid use disorder in many cases. And so it's a very much individualized treatment regimen. And so being able to partner with our physician colleagues and share data and feedback when appropriate is really a starting point.
Yeah, and I along those lines, I think it was really great what Idaho did. And I'd be interested to see if there are any numbers that have come out of it. But just recently in the past few years, Idaho State Board of Pharmacy has allowed certified pharmacy technicians there, kind of limited prescriptive authority, right, to prescribe and dispense naloxone nasal spray in patients or their family members to make sure that they have naloxone on hand if, God forbid, they ever need it, which I think is very progressive. But again, you know, you're taking a population being pharmacy technicians, you know, they're certainly not in the business by any means of diagnosing. But I think in that special case, you know, the more healthcare providers we can get trained and aware of, you know, the benefits of somebody having naloxone on hand should they need it, I think the better, you know.
Yes, and I'll just share that a number of states, I think the majority of states have policies or regulations or statutes pertaining to naloxone dispensing. The challenge is it's underutilized, and so we've still got some barriers that we have to overcome, things like insurance, patients feeling they don't need it, so those kind of things. But we know for one thing is that the one drug that saves lives in the opioid epidemic or pandemic, if we want to call it that, is naloxone. And so easy access to naloxone is critical to decreasing opioid overdose deaths, for sure.
I love interprofessional care, and I think we need to step outside. I've said this in so many hot mics. We need to step outside of healthcare too. This idea that we in healthcare, or quite frankly, we in pharmacy, pharmacists and pharmacy technicians are going to solve the issue, is just not one of those attainable goals. If you think about it, the vast majority of overdoses, drug overdoses in our country, is illegal substances. So it's literally what is not coming out of a pharmacy. Yet one of our main avenues for addressing the issue is in the pharmacy, which, by the way, it's not a let's not man every man, woman, and child with naloxone. It the more people that have it in our train, the better. But it also is a location thing. We need to learn from real estate agents. It's getting it out in the community. The fact that there is not naloxone next to every defibrillator in this country is something that I hope it's 20 minutes, but in 20 years, we'll look back on and be like, what, why didn't we do that? Or on an airplane or in a mall or in a library or anywhere in the community, quite frankly. I can't even count how many people have trained on naloxone. One of them being our five-year-old. For crying out loud, a five-year-old can handle the administration. I don't know about if somebody was actually dying in front of him. That's a whole nother psychological adventure. But it's spraying something in the nose. It's relatively easy in that partial part of it all. So, you know, look to SAMHSA and others for the true, you know, the full guidelines and all that in administration. But if you don't have it around, training's all for naught. And that's where it really gets tricky, where this issue is well beyond healthcare and needs to be addressed well beyond healthcare too. So
I agree with Mark. We need to partner with our local community organizations, churches, civic organizations. There's a non-for-profit on the news the other day that was dispensing naloxone at large music concerts this summer throughout the country because they had data that supported that many times there's unintended deaths due to drug overdose at these concerts. And so getting creative with getting the life-saving medication naloxone out in the community is critical to help solving the crisis.
Yeah, that's a great point. And I think underlying all of this is understanding and continuing to drive the fact that this is a disease and not a defect of, you know, moral turpitude on behalf of the patients who are using these medications. You know, it's not as easy as saying, well, I'm not, you know, years ago, we had some pharmacies where I was practicing in Tucson that were just like, well, we're not going to stock or dispense Plan B because that goes against my moral code. This isn't that situation. This is like giving someone glucagon when they are in a hypoglycemic state, you know, getting more and more people to recognize that this is a disease that needs to be treated as such, I think is key. And that also goes beyond healthcare. I think just general population needs to have a better understanding of that. Well, this is great information. I did want to mention the journal where Dr. Wheeler's research is located is published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health. And Dr. Wheeler, correct me if I'm wrong, but that is an open source journal, right? So anybody can have access to that. So we'll definitely be sure to include the link in our show notes to any of our listeners who are interested in reading your research firsthand. So what's next, Dr. Wheeler? Is there a planned follow-up to this research, or how can we take this to the next level?
We do. So, well, we have a couple of calls for action that we've discussed previously, but we'll also have coming out, hopefully within the next year, is the results of our survey. So we did both some focus groups with technicians, and we also had a national survey go out with NHA support. And so we want to take a national snapshot of what's going on, and particularly focusing on the pharmacy technician's perspective. Too often that they get ignored in the literature, and really they're key players in helping us combat this crisis. And so really we want to invest in resources and education and training specifically for people who are on the front lines, including pharmacy technicians.
That's great. Definitely look forward to seeing some more data and research, and hopefully that all of this together will help to change the tides and possibly how we treat these patients and provide the best level of healthcare that we can. So, guys, I really appreciate the conversation today. I think it's always worthwhile to have these conversations. We've all seen in practice these things play out, you know, and I don't want to be all doomsday because I've, you know, had the pleasure of helping a number of patients who are just wonderful people, you know, who fell into something that they really did not intend to fall into, you know, and get back out of it. So this is really great information. Dr. Groffoli, Dr. Wheeler, thank you so much for joining today.
Thank you.
Thank you as well. You're very welcome.
Thanks for listening to Pharmacy Focus Technician Edition with NHA, a podcast dedicated to providing relevant information for pharmacy technicians as well as those who advocate for the advancement of pharmacy technician practice and all of those in the pharmacy industry who rely on the work performed by pharmacy technicians every day on their restless pursuit of providing safe, reliable, and life-improving care to all patients.